Human history is marked by a junkyard of ideas that never quite got into regular use. That's certainly true of efforts in military and intelligence. Many ideas have popped up, gotten some testing, and been sent off to the junkyard. It's easy now to laugh at things like the idea of strapping bombs to flying bats, but the atomic bomb itself probably caused some skepticism decades ago, and nobody's laughing now. Vince Houghton scanned the junkyard of military and intelligence projects and ideas for a book called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince Houghton works at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., where he's the historian and curator. He also creates and hosts a podcast called Spycast. Vince is an Army veteran with a Ph.D. in military and diplomatic history. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So does a guy with your credentials not laugh as hard at the jokes about military intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, I was never military intelligence myself, so I can make fun of them all I want to.
Okay. I didn't realize how new the current home of the Spy Museum is. Tell us about that.
We are so new that we are in our fourth day of existence. The Spy Museum as an entity has been around since 2002, but we just did a major move within Washington, D.C., opened up a brand new building, custom built for us, that just opened up on May 12th. So if you're in a chance to come to D.C. this summer, you'll get a chance to still have that new museum smell inside the Spy Museum.
It's a beautiful building. I noticed that the new museum exterior is actually fairly transparent. I wonder if you're trying to send a message with the architecture at the Spy Museum.
Oh, there's definitely a message being sent. I mean, it's kind of the mixture of transparent and opaque at the same time. And the architects, they told us, they're like, you know, we thought about the Spy Museum and kind of what it brings and what it stands for. And they made a very conscious decision about that.
Oh, that's excellent. Now, the book is about the intersection of desperation and innovation. As you point out, necessity is the mother of invention, but what's desperation?
Desperation is the drunk uncle. And I think that, you know, sometimes desperation leads to fantastic inventions. The SR-71 is a great example, if you know
the Blackbird?
Gorgeous Blackbird. I mean, the spy plane that just, as a kid, made me want to be a pilot. That, I say as a kid, it still makes me want to be a pilot. I mean, it's a gorgeous aircraft. Desperation led to us designing that aircraft and many other things. I mean, things we use every day, GPS. Desperation led to the creation of the internet. These were times when, you know, we were pushed beyond the normal limits of creative thinking. And we had to solve problems that no one had ever even thought about tackling before. And in some cases, this led to some extraordinary, amazing things. In other cases, not so much.
Well, so I guess the point here is that you got to put a bunch of stuff out there. You got to see what sticks to the wall and what doesn't, but you have to throw a bunch of things at the wall first.
Well, in the cases that I'm covering, specifically World War II and the Cold War, we were in a position where we had incredibly hard problems to solve, and we had a true existential threat. I mean, that word gets thrown around a lot, you know, talking about Iran's an existential threat. No, they're not, right? Existential threat, by definition, means a threat to our existence. World War II, the Nazis could potentially be considered an existential threat, certainly to Europe, but maybe even to the United States. And during the Cold War, the fact that the Soviet Union had over 65,000 nuclear weapons at the height of the Cold War makes them a true existential threat. And in those cases, we, at the time, were terrified of the possibility of our entire way of life being extinguished. And so we thought of innovative ways, and sometimes not so innovative ways, to try to solve these problems. And you know, they kind of say in brainstorming sessions, there are no bad ideas.
Right.
There are some bad ideas, and this is a book full of them.
Well, you hooked me with the case for going beyond outcome history. I mean, failure really is important, as you point out.
Well, that was something that was shoved into my head as a graduate student. My PhD advisor just said, if we only look at outcome history, then we're unfairly applying our 2020 hindsight on historical events. We look back at things, and we're only kind of viewing them through the lens of, we know they happened the way they did. We know the outcome. We know that World War II ended in a victory for the Allies. We know the Cold War ended in a whimper and not a bang. So when we apply that 2020 hindsight to historical events, we're really not doing both the historical actors a favor, we're kind of applying our hindsight unfairly to them, but really we're not learning anything. We're not being fair to ourselves. And the only way that we can actually learn from history is put ourselves in the shoes of those people making the decisions at the time. And so ignore the outcome. It doesn't matter whether or not something worked or didn't work. I mean, I even say in the book, if a freak storm washed up on June 6, 1944 and blew the Normandy invasion off course and it failed, would Eisenhower's plan be seen as less genius than it was? Well, I think it would if you look at it through the lens of outcome history. but that's really unfair. That has nothing to do with anything Eisenhower could have planned. A freak nature event like that is not something that helps us determine historically whether or not this was a good idea or not. And so we're in a position where we just don't learn a whole lot from looking at history through that lens. You know, what I want people to do, you're going to read this book, if you do, and your immediate knee-jerk reaction is going to be, God, what were they thinking? And I want you to ask that question, but I want you to ask that question without the kind of connotation attached to it. I want you to ask that question, what were they thinking? What was going through the heads of these policymakers, these decision makers, scientists, and engineers at the time these programs were either being tested or being, you know, developed? What were they thinking about? And I think if you do that, then you can actually learn something from this book. If not, fine. They're fun stories. You know, you're still going to enjoy it, I think. But if you want to take it to the next level, that's the way to approach this.
But Vince, let's get into this. How fine is the line? I mean, you just made the case that a stronger wind on June 6, 1944 would have made Eisenhower a goat instead of a hero. Are there things that might have made it in this book, but because the line went just to the other side of them, they ended up becoming a reality?
Well, I mean, I mentioned the SR-71. That's a great example. This is an aircraft that when it's on the ground, its fuel tanks leak. Imagine being the pilot of an aircraft that flies at 80,000 feet at three times the speed of sound, and you're sitting there ready to take off and looking back and seeing fuel leaking out of the back of your aircraft. And this was a purposeful design specification, because when the aircraft reaches altitude and speed, the friction, and there's a massive amount of friction, heats up the airframe. When metal heats up, it expands. And the metal expands and actually seals the fuel tanks in flight. Now, this is a ridiculous idea, but it worked, and it worked perfectly. We can imagine what would have happened if the first SR-71 test flight exploded in midair. Then we would not be talking about this as one of the most revolutionary aircraft ever built, and arguably one of the most revolutionary engineering projects ever built.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. The book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince Houghton from the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., 4 days into its new quarters, is our guest. You can join the conversation by phone or by email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Vince Houghton. He is the historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., that just moved into new headquarters. He's written a book about things that people came up with to try to protect the United States or advance the intelligence capabilities of the United States that sound wacky now, but they were created from desperation during World War II and the Cold War. The book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, with your questions and comments by phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I should point out the book is divided into four sections. Part one is about animals, part two about covert operations, part three about innovative technology, and part four I call asinine atomics. Let's go to the title.
Where were you when I was titling these?
I'll give you editing help on the next one. How's that?
Yes.
To this event, the title event in the book, as it is in the back, did somebody want to blow up the moon? Help us understand what the basic idea was here.
No one was trying to blow up the moon. That would be unfeasible with the kind of technology we had at the time. But it's probably even worse, is that after Sputnik in 1957, which really shook Americans' confidence in their own abilities, but also the American foreign policy community's confidence in our ability to win the Cold War. And a lot of people kind of say, well, it's just a beach ball-sized metal object making a beeping noise circling the Earth. How can that have such a huge impact? Well, yes, it made us kind of come to Jesus moment when it came to American science and technology. How have we fallen behind the Soviets? But in the zero-sum game of the Cold War, where both the United States and the Soviet Union were doing everything they could to recruit people within the developing world and countries within the developing world to follow our way of life, we were throughout Latin America and Africa and East Asia saying American capitalist democracy was the way to go. And the Soviets were doing the same thing, but talking about communism. And a lot of times, we weren't doing this through bullets or guerrilla operations. We're doing this through culture. We're doing this through, look at us. Our society is better because, in our case, we produce the airplane, the incandescent light bulb, the chocolate chip cookie, microwave popcorn, right? We are the country of innovation. We've always been the country of innovation. So be like us, and you can innovate. Well, all of a sudden, the Soviets in 1957 beat us at our own game. They put the first artificial satellite in space, and a couple of years later, would launch the first human into space in Yuri Gagarin, 1961. So we had to kind of say, all right, how do we make the world know that the United States is really the big kid on the block? And so there's an idea that bandied about the Air Force of, you know what, how do we do something that everyone on Earth can watch simultaneously that would make a big splash and that we have kind of the technological feasibility to pull off? And the idea was, can we detonate an atomic bomb on the moon? Sounds ridiculous. And of course, what self-respecting scientists would agree to do this? Well, a lot of them did. The project was passed to a man named Leonard Riefel, who many people don't know the name now, but he eventually would be the deputy director of the Apollo program. So this is a serious guy in space. And for people who don't care anything about space or science, and just like watching sports, he also invented the telestrator, which is, you know, how we know what spider 2Y banana actually means, you know, when we're watching football on Sundays. So this is a polymath. This is a guy who was actually called into Ukraine and Belarus after the Chernobyl incident. This is somebody who's written books in multiple languages. This is a serious scientist. And Riefel was asked by the Air Force to investigate this. And he said, okay, well, I know a lot about this stuff, but I don't know everything. So he brought in a guy named Gerard Kuiper. And Kuiper, that name might ring a bell. There's actually something called the Kuiper Belt outside of Neptune. It's a bunch of ice and rocks that circle the solar system. So again, another really serious scientist. And Kuiper realized that there's going to be a ridiculous amount of math involved in this study to try to figure out everything from what the yield of the weapon would be to how the dust would expand in a vacuum like the moon. And the guy he brought in was one of his graduate students, a guy named Carl Sagan, a name that might ring a bell to some of your listeners. And so this is a plan where it sounds ridiculous, right? Let's detonate a bomb on the moon. But the people involved were hardcore, serious scientists who agreed. And that, to me, that was fascinating because I had to ask that question. What in the world would three of the most prominent scientists of the 20th century be doing agreeing to this kind of a program, trying to investigate the motivations of these guys? Again, going back to, what were they thinking? And that fascinates me about every one of these chapters, in particular this one.
We can come back to the hijinks with the moon. We're talking to Vince Houghton about his book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. So let's come back down to earth into the first segment of the book about animals. And did we mangle a cat for a listening device?
We think so. One of the fun things about this book is that they are intelligence or top secret military operations. It's one thing when something's happened, you actually have an outcome. You can read a newspaper article about it, or there's an after action report for the military. It's another thing when there actually wasn't a program in the end, right? When it was canceled beforehand. So you have to kind of dive into archives in a way that you wouldn't have to otherwise. You have to talk to people and try to convince people to tell you things that is very easy for them just not to tell you, to keep secret, because there's no physical evidence of any of these programs. And so the first chapter in the book is a chapter called Acoustic Kitty. And not me making this up, you know, I'm not as creative as you are when you're going to rename the fourth section. Acoustic Kitty was an official CIA program, and it was an attempt to create a covert listening device out of a common house cat. And the idea behind it probably came, at least one of the urban legends behind the story was, CIA officers in Istanbul were observing the Soviet embassy, like we do, and noticed that Istanbul's full of stray cats, just cats walking around, and everyone's kind of is okay with that. It's just kind of the charm of the city. And everyone noticed these stray cats were wandering in and out of the Soviet compound, and nobody paid them any attention. In fact, people were having high-level, you know, secret conversations inside the mid-courtyard of the Soviet embassy, and the cats were just kind of sitting there, even like sitting on the laps of the Soviet officials, maybe scratching them behind the ears. And this probably spurred the idea of, hey, look, what better way to infiltrate a covert listening device into some of the most sensitive places, then embed it within a house cat.
So off they went with Project Acoustic Kitty. We'll compress some of the details here. It didn't work. Sure. That's why it's in the book. But the CIA did have a final report on this. And why is it so redacted? Is that some indication that some redactions are just done out of embarrassment?
I don't think so, actually. I think it's redacted to protect the guilty, to protect those that worked on it specifically. But I think it's also redacted because even in these plans may not have come to fruition. I don't like calling them failures because they never really got a chance to fail. Some of these plans, even though they didn't come to full fruition, certainly spurred on other innovations. I mean, anyone who kind of works within engineering or science and technology realizes there's no such thing as failures. There's learning experiences. So even when something falls on its face, even when something doesn't work as well as you'd like it to, you learn what not to do, or you might discover a better way of doing things. And so I think Acoustic Kitty, for all of its, you know, ridiculousness, probably spurred on some interesting innovations. And I can guess as to what they might have been. Certainly in acoustic technology, mm-hmm. and the ability to create listening devices, the CIA was always looking, and they're still looking for more efficient and better technological means of gathering information by eavesdropping. I imagine certainly understanding the brain was a big part of this. Acoustic Kitty kind of coincided at the same time with another project called MKUltra, which people may be familiar with, a kind of focus on CIA's use of LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs to mind control and Manchurian candidate type thing. But within that program, there are actually 150 different sub-programs, and several of them included electronic brain stimulation of animals and trying to understand ways to overcome natural instincts within the animal kingdom. So I have a feeling, if I had to guess, that Acoustic Kitty, for all its, again, ridiculousness, probably ended up teaching the CIA some important lessons, and they certainly don't want that to be made public.
Okay, I can now it's starting to make a bit more sense here. We're talking to Vince Houghton about his book Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince is an Army veteran, PhD in military and diplomatic history, is the historian and curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange about some of the things we've done in military and intelligence realms that didn't quite get off the drawing board, or at least got tested, but didn't come to final fruition. Let me pause for just a moment here and ask generally about animals and spying. When you probably saw the news story recently about the beluga whale with the harness,
right?
That showed up. Yeah, no surprise there, I imagine.
No, I mean, animals have been used for defense purposes, for intelligence purposes, for quite some time. I mean, some of the earliest overhead reconnaissance done in the First World War were pigeons with cameras attached to them. And we actually have a great display here at the museum, not to kind of give us a little bit of advertisement here, but they basically created cameras that were small enough to fit on a pigeon, and they were automatic. So you basically would wind them up and they would take pictures automatically. And then the pigeon would be released and was trained to fly back to its cage, back to the headquarters. And if it flew over enemy territory, you basically had a spy aircraft that was flying over and taking pictures of what your enemy was doing. And in World War I, when you had the trench systems and the stalemate, this was a huge innovation. And so we've been using animals for a long time. Today, we use animals in multiple ways to protect ports. Dolphins and sea otters and others are trained to sense when something's out of the ordinary in an important port complex and to let people know about it. And then there's the kind of the old canary in the coal mine idea that goes back a very long time to kind of understand that animals have certainly some ways of sensing things that we don't. Sensory perceptions that humans don't have that we can use very effectively if we understand what they are.
All right, then there are cases in which animals were used for testing in ways that might shock us now, but it ends up laughable. And I had to explain to my partners in the newsroom why I was laughing out loud at the OSS plan to have prostitutes supply Botox to our enemies.
Right, yeah. So the problem was that this is where you run into a situation where communication just doesn't happen. There was a potential plan to have call girls, for lack of a better term, provide a biological weapon in this case, or a chemical weapon, depending on what kind of perspective you take, to high-level ranking members of the Japanese military, the Japanese diplomatic corps. The problem was the the weapon was, like you talk about, botulism, which is, you know, kind of the foundation for the cosmetic Botox. And you got to give these guys credit for it. They said, okay, this took several weeks to be shipped over here to East Asia from OSS headquarters. We don't necessarily know if it's going to work. We don't want to put our assets, in this case, our prostitutes, in harm's way if the actual toxin is not going to work. So let's test it. And in this case, they tested it on donkeys because that was something that was readily available. Let's make sure this stuff works. And to their dismay, none of the samples of the biological chemical weapon that they were given worked. And so they threw them away. They said, oh, well, I guess, you know, we're not going to, certainly not going to send our prostitutes in with a weapon that doesn't work. And then wrote a memo back to headquarters and said, we tested the stuff on donkeys. It didn't work, so we disposed of it. Now, the problem is botulism as a chemical weapon, as a toxin, just about kills every living thing on the planet. I think you can guess, like, the lone exception.
Let me guess. Four feet and says hee-haw.
Yeah. And so they incidentally tested botulism, the weapon that OSS had. Boy, they put a lot of time into creating the perfect weapon. This is something where you got to figure they had to make it to where it was easily accessible for the prostitutes and easily hideable. And there's not a lot of ways to conceal chemical toxins on a prostitute's body. So we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty. This is a family show, I imagine. But this is a lot of work that the OSS put into this. And for their guys on the other end to kind of throw this out because they decided on using the one animal on the planet that was immune to botulism toxin kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of the stories in this book.
Indeed. We have a couple of comments for you already, Vince. Lane in Medford mentions that he guarded the SR-71 and says they were awesome planes. And then we have a phone call from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the author of Nuking the Moon.
Hiya.
Hi.
Great program. Thank you. I wonder how many of your listeners realize that Ken Kesey first encountered LSD when he was in the Ultra, or
MK Ultra?
Yeah, the MK Ultra program back in the early 50s.
Wow.
What I want to mention is that the GPS system that lots of us are, well, I don't have a car, but when I'm in a car occasionally, the GPS system seems to be really helpful to get people either to the place where they want to go or really lost. But I wonder how many folks realize that the GPS system was developed back in, the early 1970s, perhaps, or in the 70s, as a way to do a Pearl Harbor attack on the Soviet Union, to have a first strike to hit their command and control systems within 90 feet of where we wanted to put a missile. In other words, to attack first.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I'm just wondering if your guest can discuss that a little bit and the ethics associated with that.
I bet he can. Thanks, Skeeter. Appreciate it. Vince?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so GPS, along with the internet and several other things, were developed in at least funded by an organization called DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And DARPA, at the time, was called ARPA. They just didn't have the D part at the beginning, defense. And this was an organization, it still is an organization, that puts a lot of money into innovative technologies. And at the time, GPS was an innovative technology. And for many years, most of our intercontinental, medium range, and intermediate range, ballistic missiles were guided by gyroscopes. Essentially, it was using old-fashioned ballistic technology to get it from point A to point B. Send it up in a parabolic arc and do some geometry, and you know where it's going to land. Well, that's great with horseshoes, hand grenades, and nuclear weapons when you actually are just kind of taking a city out. But when you want to do something called counterforce, and counterforce is very specific about focusing on the enemy's nuclear weapons themselves. So we use our nukes to take out their nukes. Now, if you're going to focus on counterforce operations, then you need to have incredibly accurate nuclear weapons. Forget 90 feet. You need to drop it on a dime. And so GPS was one of these systems, which, and there's others, but one of these systems that was designed not only for navigation of ships, navigations of tanks and everything else, but also for making nuclear weapons far more accurate so that we could have a devastating first strike against the Soviet Union. Now, the ethics of this are tricky because you're really getting into a hypothetical what-if question. And this is also a question that comes up when you talk about things like the 2003 Iraq War. And where a lot of Americans learn these terms that have been bandied about the military and defense planners for years and years, and that's preventative war versus preemptive war. And that's where you kind of we go down, you know, like with Alice down the rabbit hole. Preventative war is where you're saying, down the road sometime, this country may become a threat, so I'm going to hit them now so that I'm not worried about them later on. Preventative war is a bit of a no-no. It's not something that people generally think is a good idea. And the UN and the international community doesn't like it all that much, hence the fact that we had like three countries that went into Iraq with us. Now, preemptive war is when they're fueling their missiles, or you intercept through signals intelligence or communications intelligence an order coming from the Kremlin to the Soviet nuclear forces to launch their missiles, and you do it first. That, on the other hand, since the full history of warfare is considered totally kosher. And if all of a sudden we hit them first because they played a draw and we just outdraw them, then ethically, I think that's okay. Preventive war, on the other hand, not so much.
All right, much more to talk about with Vince Houghton from the International Spy Museum. His book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Vince and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Vince Houghton, curator and historian at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. He's talking about how desperation to win World War II and to win a possible World War III led to a lot of inventions that didn't quite make the final cut. The book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. You can join our conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Vince, we have to talk about bat bombs. I mentioned them in our web entry. This is just like it sounds, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is one where there's not a lot of chapters in this book where you kind of sit back and go, that might have worked. This is one where, if I kind of give an objective look at it, I can think this may have been a pretty good plan in the end. And certainly the guy who came up with the plan, till the day he died, decades later, argue that this would have been a much more humane and just as effective way to end World War II as the atomic bombs were. And the guy behind this idea was a man named Lytle Adams, and he was a dentist out of Pennsylvania. And he was on vacation in the southwest United States, and he heard about Pearl Harbor the way most Americans did at the time on radio. Now, he had just been visiting all of the caverns and caves out in the southwest United States and realized there were just millions and millions of bats available to us here in the United States. And he had a bit of an epiphany as he was driving. He said, okay, bats like to find dark, cool, dry places to kind of roost when they want to go to sleep and they want to find some good area that they're not necessarily worried about anyone coming along and doing it. That's why they go to caves, right? They want to get out of the way and they want it to be dark and they want it to be safe. Now, if you think about what that means for houses, that would be an attic, that would be an easement, that would be a nook and cranny. Anyone who's actually accidentally found a bat inside their house, which happens from time to time, realizes they find their way up into the roofs or in the attics. Well, then he had a second epiphany. He said, well, Japan, who we're fighting this war against now after Pearl Harbor, has houses and buildings galore made of wood, or even paper. So if you combine bats with incendiary devices and drop them over Japan, they will naturally go find their ways into the attics and easements and nooks and crannies of all these wooden and paper houses. And so when the incendiary devices go off, it's not so good for the bat, but it's even worse for the Japanese buildings because you can simply burn Japan to the ground without nuclear weapons. And to him, this was the perfect weapon. And incidentally, to the United States military, this sounded like a pretty good idea also.
There was a side effect, though, from testing this that you get into in the book. What happened?
Yeah, so a bit of a Keystone Cops situation here, where they went and collected the bats using big nets and they had to bring them actually to the test site. And so the first time they did this, they put the bats into hibernation because they didn't want to have these bats flying all over the place. They had to put them in the back of a truck, put them into hibernation, and kind of did the mental math and said, okay, these bats, if we cool them down to put them in hibernation, so if we warm them up, they should be awake just in time to fly to our test site. So they brought them up in the airplane, and they put them in the container that they're going to kind of drop them down in. But they miscalculated, and they dropped the container full of bats, and none of the bats woke up. And so I don't care if you've got wings. I don't care if you've got great aerodynamics or if you're lighter than air. If you're asleep, you're going to hit the ground just as hard as we are if you're a bat. So the first test went very badly for both the bats and the engineers. So the second time, they decided they weren't going to make that mistake again. And they had a full-scale test set up outside of a working U.S. Army airfield where the commander of the airfield had no idea what they were testing. This is a beyond top secret. So they built a test city, and they trucked the bats over. And this time, they weren't going to make that mistake. So they started bringing the bats out of hibernation a little earlier so they wouldn't be dead asleep by the time they dropped them. But they miscalculated in the other direction in this case. And so when they opened the doors to the truck that was carrying the bats, most of them were already awake, and they just flew off in every direction. One problem was that they had already been fitted with their incendiary devices that were on a timer. The good news is the test city was burned to the ground. So the technology worked, and it worked perfectly. The bad news is so was the U.S. Army airfield. Because the bats didn't just go to the test city. They went anywhere they could find a building in a dark, quiet spot to hibernate, to go to sleep. And the U.S. Army airfield burned to the ground. The commander had no idea that there was a test going on. And, in fact, tried to get into the airfield to put it out with his fire team, and they were denied because they didn't have the need to know what was going on in the operation.
Wow. So I get it that Lytle Adams was greatly affected by the Pearl Harbor attack and had been around bats in the American Southwest. This was also 2 years after Batman first appeared. Was there any indication that played a part?
Not that I know of. I'm probably going to get sued for that first beginning part of the chapter where I kind of steal a little bit of the light from Batman.
Uh-huh.
What's part of this is actually a much better understanding of bats at the time, because this is... Lytle Adams wasn't stupid. He had this idea, this epiphany, and he went to research it and actually talked to some scientists at Harvard and MIT and people that had started to understand how bats worked. A man named Donald Griffin, who actually came up with the concept that bats navigate using echolocation. So this is the guy who figured out how bats work, and he was part of this operation. So if you look at this again and go, God, this is just a bunch of wackadoodles coming up with these crazy plans. No. It's the world's leading expert on bats was involved in this operation. And then they worked with an explosive expert, a guy who actually later would invent napalm. So this is somebody, again, who was at the top of his field, who was working on these kinds of projects. And what really ended up happening is the only reason this was canceled was because of the atomic bomb. This may have been a program that was actually put into practice if it wasn't for the fact that the war ended before they got a chance to see if it really worked.
So not so much that this was a technology that didn't work. It just took a lot more work than the other alternative, which worked out quite well, which was the atomic bomb. I know some people will not think the atomic bomb worked well and that it killed so many people, but the point was that it functioned as it was anticipated to do. Ultimately, I want to get Vince into the sense of desperation of losing World War III as the Cold War got deeper. So, for example, what was Project Washtub about?
So this was one of my favorite chapters because as of 2014, so just a couple of years ago, there were 10,000 documents, pages of classified documents that were declassified about this project. And this is for anyone like me who grew up in the 1980s and watched Red Dawn on TV and imagined like what would happen if the Soviets invaded, or in my case, I'm from South Florida, I'm from Miami. You know, what if the Cubans decided to invade South Florida? Like, how would I react? How would I fight back like the people in Red Dawn? Well, we had contingency plans for this back in the 1950s because the one place that the Soviets might be able to invade, they certainly didn't have the amphibious capability of crossing the Atlantic or the Pacific, was crossing the Bering Straits into Alaska. And so there's a plan, a joint operation between the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover and the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations, which is a new unit within the Air Force that was going to do special projects like this one. And Project Washtub called for creating a large group of what we in the intelligence community call stay-behinds. These are people, intelligence officers, agents, who during an invasion just kind of melt into the countryside. And once the invasion is over, once the country, the invading country, takes control and tries to consolidate their power, that's when they come back in. They pop back up out of hiding and do everything the OSS and the SOE did in World War II. The resistance, they blow up bridges, they sabotage aircraft, they create paramilitary operations and make the Soviets like a living hell. They collect intelligence so the United States government knows what's going on, what kind of units are coming over, what kind of technology they have. So essentially, we wanted to create a cadre of James Bonds in Alaska in case the Soviets invaded. And this is a program that actually, you could argue, went into actual operation. We trained dozens of Alaskan natives to become super soldiers and super spies in the case of a Soviet invasion.
Wow. So there are some still out there, you're saying?
Well, the great thing about these kind of programs is when they declassify all these documents, but they're heavily redacted. And many of their rosters for some of the people who were recruited into this program only include about 40% or so of those recruited. So we know, you know, 4 out of 10 names. And the people we know are extraordinarily interesting, right? These are, you know, the most rugged, Bear Grylls type guys who can live off the land and eat squirrels raw and never need indoor plumbing and can live for years if necessary under Soviet occupation. And those are the only ones we know about. The ones that were redacted, it's like, what in the world made it to where these guys are still so secret in 2019 that we can't know their names?
So while we're talking about Alaska, let's talk about other cold places like icebergs, because there's a whole section, a whole chapter in the book about an idea for an aircraft carrier. What happened there?
Yeah, so this is the Allies were running into real problems during the Second World War and getting goods, materials, resources across the Atlantic. The German U-boat operation was being very effective in sinking merchant shipping and preventing us from resupplying Great Britain, which is an island, which means if it doesn't have resupply by sea, it potentially can get starved out. And, of course, the resupply, the operations in North Africa after 1942, in Italy after 1943, and in France after 1944. The problem was that the only aircraft that could land and take off from aircraft carriers had to be incredibly light, had really bad armor, and had terrible armament. Now, that's okay if you're going up against other aircraft carrier-based aircraft. But what these guys were being used for was supporting ground operations. So you'd sell your aircraft carrier into the area outside of France or outside of North Africa, and then the aircraft would fly out the aircraft carrier and fight against the people on land. Now, why that mattered is that land-based aircraft, like the Germans were using, were just head and shoulders better than anything the British and the Americans could put on an aircraft carrier. But what if we could create an aircraft carrier that was big enough and strong enough to land the biggest aircraft in the world on, and was essentially unsinkable? And an inventor named Jeffrey Pike came up with this idea of, let's take an iceberg and turn it into an aircraft carrier. And you kind of chuckle at this, like an iceberg, but think about the science behind this, right? All you have to do is the next time you're drinking an iced tea or a soda, and you look at the ice inside there, and you kind of push down the ice, what does it do? Well, it pops right back up to the top, which means that ice, the buoyancy of ice, was perfect for a ship. It made it almost impossible to sink. Now, the idea was great. The ability to create something like that was really the problem. And this was probably an idea way ahead of its time. The technology and the resources that would be necessary to be put into building a single ship would have been more than the entirety of the rest of the war combined.
All right, so it didn't happen, and there, we did get some things out of there, like Pikecrete, though, which is Jeffrey Pike's invention, which combines ice and some other stuff to make a really interesting building material. I wonder, Vince, certainly in the job you have an opportunity to do this. How often do you let your mind go to the kinds of things that people in intelligence and the military are dreaming up in our time that might end up in a future book and a future generation?
Yeah, I mean, you think about these ideas that we're only finding out about decades later, and you think about, well, what we know about, so what's been released to the public, is at least a decade old. And so, like, what is happening right now in these levels? Like, what plots and plans and programs are being devised today that will be canceled at the very last minute, and we're only going to find out? Maybe my kids one day will write a sequel to this with the programs from today. I'm looking forward to it.
But you know, some of the stuff that goes on in the book, like, you know, the ways that we spy in each other's embassies, that stuff still goes on, obviously, doesn't it?
Yeah, so the techniques and the tactics don't change. The technology does. And, you know, that's true since the beginning of espionage. Espionage, we joke in the museum that espionage is the second oldest profession, with less ethics and morals than the first in many cases. So wanting to know what your enemy is doing or your adversary or even your friends is something that goes back to the very beginning of time. And some of the techniques don't necessarily change, but our ability to do it through technology has. And as we'll continue to see that moving forward for the next rest of our lives, certainly in the lives of our kids and grandkids.
Well, we certainly get a good overview of some of the things that people have come up with that came close to working in some cases and actually did and just got eclipsed by other technologies like the atomic bomb. Vince Houghton is the curator and historian at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and the author of Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, thanks so much, and best of luck with the new museum.
Hey, thank you so much.